But honest question based on what you said, is it possible for us to get more JavaScript? Can we add more JavaScript to things? What are we missing?
Hey there, Shopomaniacs! You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer. Hey, Chris, how are you? Uh-oh, Chris, hey. My last name just got progressively enhanced to Rupertatron. So I'm down Dave Rupertatron. It just upgraded while we were talking.
Oh, I see. Yeah, you shipped the minimum version of your last name, but then all the circumstances were correct, you know, the tests passed.
Yeah, the rest of the intro rendered, and then it was like, well, I can upgrade. I now have the ability to upgrade my last name.
Not only Rupertatron, but that's saved offline, so in case somebody views your last name again, it's
they have it cached locally. So there you go, on their podcatchers. Hey, Chris, what are we talking about today?
Well, I think we're going to end up talking a little bit about PWAs, but we're going to talk about probably all kinds of stuff because we have a wonderful guest today, Mr. Aaron Gustafson. I'm sorry, you do your last name.
Oh, it's Gustafson. You had it right.
I nailed it.
But I get it all sorts of different ways, but that was good.
Gustafson.
Gorfstason.
Gustafson.
Gustafson. Yeah, Wisconsin.
Chattanooga person these days at Microsoft, yeah?
Mm-hmm, and newly relocated to Seattle.
Oh, okay. Chattanooga days are over.
Yes, we moved in May, so we're now up in the PNW.
Well, welcome. There's some
congrats on all the flannel you've no doubt introduced into your life.
Yeah, well, I raided your closet, Dave.
Yeah, that's good. That's about all I have.
Yeah. but you know, aside from Microsoft and Seattle stuff, a long time kind of web hero from back in the early web standards days and web standards Sherpa and whatever WASP was and all that stuff. So maybe give us a short history of your professional career.
Oh, geez. So I have a lot of gray in my beard at this point. I used to be a youngin on the web back when I started, but I started in like 96. So I was a little late to the game by 2 years against some of the people that I've worked with. But I kind of caught the web standards bug around 2000. I think I read a Eric Meyer piece and just completely fell in love. And so I began to implement that stuff where I was freelancing at the time, and then went to an ad agency and did a lot of evangelism internally for web standards there and for accessibility and stuff. And then started speaking, back in 2003. I think I wrote my first article around 2003 as well for a list apart. And then, it's just been kind of a whirlwind ride. I joined WASP in, I think, so that's the Web Standards Project, in 2006, I think I was inducted. And then eventually I became one of the co-managers of the Web Standards Project. I've worked a list apart off and on, kind of over the years, and I'm currently the editor-in-chief there. Came to Microsoft a little over 3 years ago to continue championing web standards and accessibility. And, I've done all sorts of things. I've pretty much had every role that you could possibly have on a web project. Ran an agency for a decade before joining Microsoft, and so had like the strategy and business end of things, as well as
hype man
management and all that stuff.
Hype man is that? That's a role.
That's more you, Chris.
I would wager about 50% of the Shop Talk listening audience has no idea what the Web Standards Project was or what it did. I was wondering.
I'm not even sure if I know, really, you know.
Well, there's an article on CSS Tricks, Chris, called Short History of WASP.
I can't read everything we publish.
I guess I was wondering if you could do like a 5-minute, like, what was the Web Standards Project and why did it matter? Like a history lesson.
Sure. So the Web Standards Project sort of came about as a reaction to where we were at during the sort of height of the browser wars and the fact that everybody had kind of their own implementation of JavaScript, or, you know, you had JavaScript and then, gosh, what was it? JScript was the IE implementation back in the early days, which was a reverse engineering of JavaScript. And then everybody had different CSS stuff that they supported, sometimes different HTML elements. It was just like, imagine every TV manufacturer out there had a completely different, you know, screen size, sure, right? Or dimension or something like that. And they accepted different signals. So you could only get certain stations to play on your television and you had to have just the right matchup, right?
I have a question already though, because I think we can all imagine that, like a bunch of browsers that are all doing things differently and have different nuts and bolts and everybody's like, whoa, this sucks. You know, like we can imagine that. But where did these... Was there already a W3C defining what these things are a little bit, or does this predate that, or you know what I mean?
Like, oh, gosh, my timeline history, like I said, I'm old. I don't remember for sure. I believe the W3C existed, and I know that a lot of the early decisions around what was going on with HTML took place over mailing lists. Like if you go back in history, you can actually find Mark Anderson's pitch for the image element, which was in an email. And then he decided to go ahead and implement it in NCSA Mosaic against Tim Berners-Lee's better judgment. A lot of the people who are interested in HTML and trying to push it forward at the time were pushing for a more generic element, which was object.
Okay. But so Mark there was a group that was like, here's some things that, here's what HTML is, but they weren't as strongly pushing for like, and don't implement it interoperably poorly. Like that's where, right, that's where you stepped in. You're like, y'all bring yourselves together.
Well, I wasn't there at the very beginning for sure. They're a fantastic group of people. Zeldman was one of them. Chris Casciano.
And these are the people. The overall message being, you know, basically get your stuff together here.
Right. Basically, yeah. If we want the web to have any chance of succeeding, we need to get all on the same page.
And my general opinion of the W3C is like they do a lot and they govern things, but it takes initiatives like these, like to just, I guess, basically stir the pot and squeak the wheel so that things get done, right? That's kind of...
I don't know. I kind of look at the standards process a lot along the lines of like how the dictionary is. So the dictionary is sort of a snapshot in time of what the like how a language is evolving. Right. And in many ways, that's sort of what the standards of the W3C are like. Now, some people may disagree with me on that, but that's kind of how I view it. And so like, there's a lot of evolution that's taking place within other ancillary organizations like WebWG and stuff like that, that are, you know, a little bit, I don't know, let's say they're more willing to stick their neck out and push something forward and see if it sticks. You know, throw it up against the wall, see if it sticks. And then if there's some progress and other people are interested in uptake, then, you know, it may make it over into the W3C and into some sort of standardized spec. I think WebSQL is probably a really good example of that. For folks who remember back in the day, that was our only real client-side database that we had in sort of the early days of HTML5 and giant quotes. Where folks were able to start actually doing some serious client-side storage. And it was built on SQLite. And if I remember correctly, had implementations in Safari, Chrome, and Opera. But both Mozilla and Microsoft said, you know what, we don't think this is a good idea. There were a number of arguments against it. Mm-hmm. One was... you know, tying a spec to a product because SQLite existed as a separate open source project. So that was kind of a thing that some folks weren't comfortable with. And even though you had implementations in three different browsers, eventually that spec was abandoned and IndexedDB came along. And that was something that everybody has implemented.
It'd be like using like Twilio has great APIs. Let's, you know, WebRTC's here now. Let's just use exactly Twilio's APIs. And people would be like, what? That seems weird.
Yeah. Yeah, and embed Twilio in every browser. Right? Right. That was effectively what they were having to do with SQLite. You know, I think browsers have an opportunity to innovate and come up with ideas and bring those to the standards bodies, be it the WebWG, be it the W3C or ECMA or what have you. And sometimes, and in fact, many cases, I think those have a little bit more credence if there's some implementation that you can show to demonstrate how something works. And I think that's good. I think community groups are starting to fill this role as well, which is fantastic. You know, I think the responsive images community group was a really great success, and there's a ton of other ones that are doing some really interesting stuff. And so it's not just the browser vendors that are getting to kind of put their stamp on web tech, which I think is a good thing, the more involvement we can get. I think where I'd like to get away from is where browsers are, you know, coming up with something to either scratch their own itch or scratch the itch of the, you know, the larger company that they're a part of. And then they just kind of create this spec and throw it over the fence to a standards body and say, okay, you know, we've thought this all through. Here's the implementation. Now go and standardize it, and we're gonna go off and work on something else.
So that might be like one of these, like, I don't know, Apple's like, we need environment variables because we put this weird notch on our phone and we need a CSS way to handle it. So we did. Here you go.
Yeah, I'm not going to call out any particular companies for doing that, but I think everybody's done it at one time or another.
Oh, yeah. Every time a new Safari comes out, you just go to the Apple marketing page and they're using the new CSS that they just shipped in the browser. It's just, it's like 100% of the time, like even down back to like WebKit, like text reflect, like that wet floor was purely for their marketing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think it was trying to make Keynote on the web work, right? Like a lot of that stuff, if you think about a lot of the early animations and transition stuff that Apple came out with, was about making things like Keynote possible.
You know, I've heard though that some standards people, I don't know if they like, I don't know if this, they speak for everybody, but they kind of like it sometimes when they're given things to standardize. They're like, you know, a browser vendor is like, we need this. This is important to us, and it's important for us as a company and our users and stuff. So help us standardize it. Rather than sometimes standards people aren't they're not the brainchilds inventing all this. They're the gatekeepers in a way. They want to be standardizing things that they know people want, not just whatever they think of. So that it's not all bad, right?
No. I think, you know, innovation can and should come from anywhere. And if you have, you know, sort of a half to fully formed idea that you want to bring to a standards body, and that includes any of your listeners who have a half formed idea that they want to bring to a standards body and begin discussing, I think that's a good thing. And if you have an implementation that you can allow somebody to tinker with, I think the main thing is being open to that evolving as different considerations get brought into focus. I mean, I think we all live in our own bubbles, right? Of different you know, experiences in terms of the devices that we use, the, you know, networks that we have access to, the company concerns that we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis, wherever it is that we work. And so we're very much focused on solving our problems and thinking about how we approach something. And I think we need to be open to expanding the definition of what it is that we're working on and open to ideas from other people who have different perspectives. So as long as it's an open process, I think it's totally cool. I'm happy for people to pitch ideas. I mean, the first idea of Grid, right, came out of Microsoft years ago and was scratching an itch that Microsoft had internally. And you know what? It wasn't the ideal spec for the web. And so it evolved over time. And now we have this pretty awesome layout engine, right?
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by NativeScript. It's nativescript.org/shoptalkshow, of course. It's a great name for a product because it's how to build native apps, like native to iOS, like a native iOS app and a native Android app, which, you know, are totally two separate languages that you need to write in to create apps in that way. And obviously that's a problem, right? Like not every business can afford to rewrite an app twice, nor is it particularly efficient or very fun. So, you know, developers are always looking for a solution for that. You know, we're like, wouldn't it be nice if we could like have a web app, but also have native apps in the store? And there's web wrapper type of web view stuff you can do for that, but it's not super ideal. It's not nearly as nice as an actual legit native app code driven application. So that's what native script does. You can write your app in JavaScript, or if you want to write it in TypeScript, that's cool. You can even use a framework, Angular or Vue, super popular frameworks, of course. Write your app that way, and NativeScript turns it into a native app for you. So get 100% access to all the native APIs with JavaScript and reuse still packages from NPM, all the stuff that you're used to being able to use. You can use it with NativeScript. So pretty darn cool. Check it out, nativescript.org/shoptalkshow. Okay, so that's standard stuff, and you've been involved with that for a long time and still are, really. But you know, fast forward a whole bunch of years, like what's like got you going these days?
I'm doing a lot of thinking about progressive web apps and accessibility. Those are kind of the two areas. And then there's lots of kind of overlap with progressive enhancement and performance and all of that sort of stuff. But I'm thinking a lot about progressive web apps because that's sort of the space that I've been working in at Microsoft for the last year and a half to 2 years, I guess, somewhere in there.
I think that it's come up on the show a bit. I think some of us know about PWAs a little bit. The idea being it's kind of this checklist of things that any website can do, and you can kind of, they all have advantages. So checking anything off of those lists tends to have value. Things like this site works offline in some capacity, and this site, I don't know, works on screen sizes of any size, kind of embraces the responsive design stuff. And mm-hmm. I forget the entire checklist of things, but they're all kind of good things. And then if you do all of them or enough of them, you get kind of rubber stamped as a PWA. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's the original characteristics that, that Alex Russell put together that sort of defined what he and Francis were referring to as the kind of this new breed of web experiences that they coined, progressive web apps. And those, you know, apply in some instances to some, you know, particular types of sites, sometimes not so much. Like I don't know that anybody's really ever going to want push notifications from my blog. But you know, certainly the offline stuff, the resilience for network issues, and you know, doing good things with caching, and you know, being responsive. Those are all great characteristics for websites. He also sort of defined what I refer to as the MVPWA, the minimum viable progressive web app, which is simply running a site on HTTPS, having a web app manifest that's all the meta information about your site. And then having a service worker and having it doing at least some sort of minimal caching and offline stuff.
Now we're starting to live in an era where that's a thing now. Everybody kind of somewhat agreed on that. And now there's companies mm-hmm. like if you do meet are rubber stamped and whatever that company decides is enough to be a PWA, that you get something out of it. It's not just a fake certificate that you don't get in the mail.
Right.
It's the actual things happen. Like you're prompted to put an icon on a phone or whatever. What are the things that happen?
So, I mean, you can have add to home screen. Like Google has their whole on before install prompt, if I remember the event name correctly, that basically is the trigger once you've met a certain set of heuristics for interaction. So you've been on the site a certain number of times, spent a certain amount of time actually engaging with the site, you open it frequently, what have you, then Chrome can emit an event that as a developer you can kind of latch onto and either do something with right away, or you can hold on to it and prompt for somebody for install later. So in a lot of cases, you'll see an add to home screen thing pop up you know, just while you're in the midst of browsing around a site, if it's a PWA.
You can see why a site would want that. You could imagine a business discussion being like, listen, we want our icon on people's home screens or phones. Like, that's the thing that we want. And we want it so badly that we might even just make a native app. Just because that matters so much to us. And then to have somebody come along and say, oh, there's another way to get there that doesn't require rewriting your whole app because you already have a website. So it's not going to be no work, but it's probably going to be less work than writing an entire native app. That's probably got some people salivating a little bit.
Yeah, certainly. And I think there's some interesting ways that other companies have sort of keyed into that particular prompt for users. Like, I want to say it's Flipkart. I could be wrong, but I'm fairly certain it's Flipkart. They actually, even if the event gets handed to them, they wait until you've checked out to prompt you to install the app, because at that point you are obviously engaged enough to make a purchase via their site. And then they actually frame it as, you know, you've placed an order. If you add us to your home screen, you're going to be able to track that order and that sort of thing.
Oh yeah, but they get great engagement on that.
Mm-hmm. So you're actually having, you're providing a value proposition, which I think is always important when you're asking a user to give you some sort of additional permission, whether that's to receive notifications or to add to home screen, anything where you're sort of invading the person's personal space, right, in their digital device. I think it's good to provide a value proposition for why somebody might want to do that, which has got to up your engagement and your acceptance of that. Because if somebody comes to your site and you're immediately like, hey, let me see your location. Hey, let me send you push notifications. Hey, let me do this and that. Like, somebody's going to be like, no. And you know what? I may not come back to the site again because you're just really needy and you want all of my information. I think context is super important in providing a true value proposition to our users before we ask for sensitive information.
There's been ways in the past to like add a website to a home screen or whatever. You can kind of, as a user, kind of force it if you'd like.
Yeah, that was the original iOS apps, if you remember back in the day.
Yeah, that was the only way to do it.
That was all Steve Jobs offered, and everyone was so mad.
I actually wrote one. It was featured in one of the Apple advertisements back when there were just web apps. Yeah.
But you click it and then it opens a web view, and the web view might look a little different or something. I forget exactly what it is, but it's just a website, you know. I guess the bar is higher to some degree with the PW. Like, hopefully now, let's say you've done it, you know, your icon's on the home screen and people click it. The idea is hopefully you've done well enough as a creator of this site that it feels amazing, right? It feels like it's just as performant as any native app. It looks as close to a native app as you want it to, I guess. That, I don't know, it has some saved information. I don't know if you can like save a login or something. That's certainly a big deal. Like, that's why I would go download a Twitter app, is because I don't want to friggin' log into it every single time I tap the icon, you know? Like, do you have access to the same APIs and things like that? It's just what seems to me is like, is our PWAs good enough to win? You know, like, are they, is this their answer? Are they going to win because they're just better in all ways than the native apps? Or is that still shaking out, you know?
I mean, I actually wrote about this for Smashing Magazine a while back. And my feeling is that there's a place for both. And I think your decision to go PWA or native is a decision that needs to be made based on the needs of your project. So if you need access to device APIs that don't exist on the web, then you need to be native. If you need to be closer to the metal, so to speak, for performance reasons or whatever, you need deeper access, native is going to be the way to go. But if you're, let's say you are some sort of large scale web application that also has native applications, and you're basically providing a similar experience on the web and all of your individual native applications. If you had the opportunity to double down on your investment on one of those platforms and have it work everywhere, why wouldn't you do that, right? If there's no significant gains to building a native version of an app, then why would you want to spend the extra money and time and such doing that when you could build it once and deploy it via the web and then potentially do application wrappers for iOS, for Android, for Windows, whatever, if you want to be in those storefronts for one reason or another. Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you, make better use of your money rather than employing a ton of different teams with different skill sets, some of which may be more difficult to hire for than others. It's web talent is pretty readily available, and in comparison to native talent, tends to be a little less expensive on the whole. It's easier to find people to put in those roles, so it may end up being a lot cheaper for you in the long run to go that route.
And if
you're not having any significant advantage from being a native app in terms of user experience and stuff, then it's probably not a wise investment.
I think the wrench in all this works is that there's lots of projects out there that do it kind of both ways. They're like, I get it. You don't want to hire a whole native app team. You want to use your existing web team. But here's the carrot. Our thing is you write it with web technologies and we compile it to a native app. Are those things like cool to you, or is that like it seems like you're skipping the line here? Maybe just do the PWA thing.
I think it depends on the project. I mean, I think I've had a lot of conversations with the folks at Slack who are heavily invested in the Electron space, and they have a very I think reasonable reason why they're going Electron. They want to deliver the exact same experience across all platforms. They want to control the execution environment ultimately, which in sort of the web space, you don't always control the execution environment. So they want to provide a consistent experience across all of the different platforms they go to. They want to be able to, test to the nth degree. They, want to have a stable platform, and I totally respect that makes sense for them. So I don't have any problems with Electron, but I think, as with many things, the technical choices that we make about how we build things should be predicated on understanding the needs of the project, as opposed to just jumping in and saying, we're going to build this as a PWA without actually thinking like, what are the implications, the pros and cons of doing that and so on and so forth. I feel the same way about like people who jump the bandwagon of the latest framework and say, oh, we're going to build this in, X, Y, or Z technology without actually considering whether that's the most appropriate way to build it.
Captain Pragmatic over here. Jeez.
I love learning new things, but I like to learn new things kind of on my own time and on projects where it actually makes sense to do it. If somebody came to me and was like, hey, can you help me build a blog? Chances are I'm not going to be like, okay, you know what? I'm going to learn React and build this from scratch because React is the most sensible thing to use to build a blog. It's probably not. It's probably overkill, right?
Maybe. I think the Gatsby team might disagree with you.
No, totally. Totally. and I have yet to check out Gatsby, but it is, I've read up on it. I have not played with it yet, but one of my mentees is actually doing their documentation and stuff now. So pretty exciting.
Cool.
Shout out to Amberly Romo.
I think even if you were an Electron app, you might benefit from service worker technology. I mean, sure. You can, I'm not sure that caching really matters if you're like an embedded Chrome, but things like, fetch interception, like you can cache GIFs and emojis and whatever, and you don't have to like go fetch those from the network every single time. Those could kind of live in like a local cache or something like that. So, I mean, it seems like I've seen even just like localhost stuff, which is almost, I feel similar, it's just this machine to this Chrome instance or whatever. It's like, it's a lot faster even with the service worker. For us at Paravel, we kind of depend on progressive web apps because, we're three people. We don't have the bandwidth as the three of us to like go code an iOS code and design an iOS app, code and design an Android app, code and design a Windows Store app.
No, but you could write in native script or Flutter or React Native or something, right?
Yeah, true. I mean, those are, I guess that's like it may be right for your company, But it's like that's a big decision, you know, it pulls you out of kind of your wheelhouse of where you were, but like, which for our wheelhouse is very much web, you know? So, but I've even like, you know, CodePen, for instance, you know, like you could very, like you could just graft in just a little bit of a service worker and a little bit of a manifest and like, boom, you're kind of like getting app-like performance, you know, native app-like performance just when somebody loads up CodePen on the daily, you know?
Yeah, right.
Almost sounds like you're progressively enhancing something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's even that, I mean, I was just lobbing stuff at you just to react to it for the purposes of radio, but I get what you mean. And that even just that idea of just like, well, let's just tinker with service workers. Even that feels like a big decision to me and not something that you can just, I can just do on a Tuesday or something. It's going to have to be,
I don't know. If you sat down with Jeremy Keith's Going Offline, you probably could do it and you could read the book in probably 2 hours and probably have something up and running in about 15 to 20 minutes.
Yeah. One of the things that trips me up, and I've talked to Jeremy about this too, is that this idea of like, just, well, one of the ideas here to get offline real quickly is to take your assets, specifically things like CSS and JavaScript, if you need an image and stuff, and just chuck them, have a little manifest of what they are and chuck them into the however service workers do cache. But it doesn't handle the, okay, now I pushed a change. And for a lot of us, pushing a change is we have some kind of asset pipeline or something that is intended to invalidate the browser cache. Because we, in addition to shipping our stuff, what we've done is said, we'll ship it with a header that has like a 2,000-year caching header on it that tells the browser, right, just hold on to this thing forever. And if I ever ship a new version of it, I'll break the cache. It's on me. And so that idea is like totally possible in service workers. I mean, it means every time you push, you're pushing a new service worker too. You have to invalidate your old service worker because then the instructions inside that service worker on what to cache and where to put it change also. So like that, and that feels like table stakes to me of using this thing. So it's not just like throw a service worker up and you're good. It's like you need a thing that a build process that also updates your service worker. And that to me like brings complication to this that isn't talked about enough. That's just me.
Yeah, I think Jeremy had a good example of basically including dates, like when you rebuild your CSS or something like that, you make some sort of change, having a date as part of the file name. I forget what the post is. We can find that for the show notes. Yeah. But
I'm not saying like, oh, he totally blew the pooch on this and forgot this. The book is incredible. No. Yeah. And I love the idea of minimum viable progressive web apps and minimum viable service workers. That type of stuff pushes the needle in this industry because it lowers the scariness bar, which it definitely needs, I think, these.
Yeah, what I ended up doing for my blog, which is all Jekyll-based, and I use Gulp to build my files because, you know, I don't need something super complicated like Webpack. But I have a variable that gets updated within the JavaScript that is my service worker. So basically, when I rebuild my JavaScript, then it automatically updates that key with whatever the date is as the build time. And then, you know, that rolls out the new service worker. And I mean, the neat thing is that depending on how you are managing your caches, like you can have separate caches for your assets and separate caches for your web pages and your images and stuff like that. You can stick them in different places within using the cache API within the browser. And so, you know, if you're just pushing updates to your CSS or JavaScript, you could invalidate the cache, like the assets cache for that stuff, but maybe you don't invalidate the web page cache or the images cache or what have you. So it's not like you're throwing the entire thing out and starting fresh, but you're able to replace those individual assets in the background.
Awesome.
And I like to use, talking about service workers on the Shop Talk Show, it's hard to mouth code, but I like the network first HTML request and cache first everything else. And then, so I request HTML, always get a freshie of the HTML because I'm fixing typos on the regular. So I'm always getting a freshie HTML. And then once that comes, I'm like, cool, cache that, update that cache. And if for some reason it doesn't come, the fetch request fails, whatever. I got the bad one with typos still from the previous cache.
Yep.
And then that HTML file, because it's been requested, I'm going to, or in cached, like I'll have the CSS for that, the JS for that, and then I'm updating the like digest fingerprint or whatever on the asset, like the date stamp or the whatever. So that way my like, that way there's like probably multiple CSS files I need to go clean out, but there's always going to be kind of like a fresh set of content, or like the content should be there for all assets. They'll kind of get cached. If you ever looked at the page, it'll show up in as cached, but I always try to get the freshest stuff first, and that should update the caches and get the freshest stuff if it has it. So anyway, I should blog.
Yeah, that's a great approach. Dean Hume has some interesting stuff too, where he's done like use Service Worker to replace requests for JPEGs and such for WebP if the browser supports it. And he just has WebP version as well.
That way really? Cool.
Didn't need to change his markup. Yeah. And there was another one I saw that he did that I mentioned in the PWA tweet chat thing that I did the other day, which was he uses Service Worker plus the Network Information API to determine if you're on a slow network. And if you're on a slow network, any image requests actually return a gray SVG instead. And so that gets inserted into the images. So they still take up the same amount of space in the document when it's rendering in, but the images actually don't load.
I do that. Yeah.
I love thinking about it as this, like, it's, we always talk about caching. That's like probably the number one thing that gets brought up when service workers are up. But what it really is this low level access to when browsers request things, what you do with them. There's probably even more stuff involved because it has to do with push notifications and all this. But it's like you can change, you know, you can almost play practical jokes. Hey, the browser requested this URL. I'm a man in the middle. Mm-hmm. I can return whatever I want. I can return you a string of gibberish instead if I wanted to. Practical jokes aside, we've even talked about it at CodePen. Like, there's a future in which there's like one URL that represents like a REST API for like pre-processing, because that's one of the things that we offer at CodePen, right? Like, you write some SAS and we'll process it for you. So we might have an endpoint that's like preprocessors.codepen.io/SAS or something, and you hit that with some SAS and it returns some stuff. Well, that's great, but like, I wonder if, you know, service workers could get involved here and like make some intelligent choices about where to get that SAS processed. Like, if you're online and we've determined it's a really fast network, maybe we'll just send it out to our cloud function for doing that. Or maybe like you've fired up a web worker, like we have, you know, and maybe we'll send it to that if the conditions are just right, we'll use that. And how cool would that be, you know, to like be making choices about what responds to the same URL endpoint, like what's the perfect thing? And I'm like, ah, that's so cool. We haven't actually done it yet, but that would be cool.
No, that's pretty cool. I mean, if you think about it, it's sort of its own, like I like saying it's your own personal man in the middle, just like you mentioned, but it's almost like your own ability to, I don't know, have like some what would be traditionally a server side logic in the client side, but managing all of the requests. So yeah, anything can sort of become as though it's a single page app.
Yeah,
but it's not.
Who do you think should write? You know, that's why this is so gray, all this industry that we work in, like, who writes a service worker? Is that a front-end developer? Is that a DevOps person? Is it a back-end developer? Is it just whoever happens to know?
I feel like ideally it should be a team, and that there should be some sort of documentation around like what are our end goals? What are we trying to implement? You know, it should be built in some sort of modular way so that, you know, as different concepts roll in or out, that you can easily kind of push and pull them to the overall service worker. I hesitate to say that it's complicated enough that it needs a framework. I don't know. I haven't really felt the need to explore things like Workbox yet. I think in a lot of cases, the service worker recipes that are out there and thing code that people have shared is probably enough for most use cases. But I think thinking about service workers in a modular way and having a conversation between front-end folks and designers and the DevOps folks is a good idea so that everybody's on the same page. And, you know, honestly, even the business and product owners, so that they can weigh in on, you know, what is the most important thing. You know, like Dave was talking about the HTML, you know, if there's a network connection, the HTML is the most important thing to always get fresh. You know, that may not be the case in some instances. Maybe people want to, you know, always start with the cached version and then request the new version in the back and then, you know, replace it or something like that. Ali Alabas actually has a really great example in his talk from the Microsoft Build conference this year, where he had a weather app that starts out by showing the last weather that you got, but the whole page is sort of grayscale. And then when it loads in the new information, it switches to being full color and has like the latest information. And obviously there's some additional language around like this has been updated as of, you know, this time and date and stuff like that. But I think that's kind of a really interesting pattern. And again, it depends on what your product is and what you're trying to accomplish. So getting as many people together to discuss service worker strategy is probably going to result in the best, most long-lived service worker configuration.
Pinafore, which is a Mastodon client by Nolan Lawson, who's an ex Microsoftie, it goes gray when you're offline. Mm-hmm. Like the whole thing like turns gray, and it's usually pretty vibrant colors, and it's so cool. Mm-hmm. Like, I just was like, this is the best experience ever, because you're like, I am offline, and it does look kind of desaturated and dead. And it's not working. This is great. Like, and it tells me like visually kind of, hey, you're using like cached stale stuff. I think that's great.
It's kind of funny to see how native APIs shake out. Like, is the API so good that people just use it? Or is it look like, you know, like Fetch is a pretty simple API that everybody's like, oh, thank God, now we have a, you know, kind of a one-liner Ajax-y API. But I find most usage of it is wrapped somehow. They use some kind of wrapper around it to not just polyfill it, but like deal with error handling and make it so you don't have to do that weird double promise callback thing or whatever. And I don't know that that means that Fetch like failed as an API, or it should have been better, but maybe it does a little bit. And that we haven't seen that so much with service work. I haven't seen this workbox thing, but it seems interesting that what it's kind of saying is service worker is a little too complicated to work with directly. We made some APIs that might, you know, resonate with you better because it has, but we'll see if this really takes off. Then it was kind of proves that service workers either doesn't have as nice of an API as it should have, or is like too low level that it's not, it's just like scaring people away. They want to work with it at a higher level of abstraction.
Absolutely.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by the widely beloved DigitalOcean. So here's the URL I'm going to send you to, my favorite URL in the world, do.co/shoptalk. Of course it is. That's $100 of free credit if you go to that URL, so you might as well do that, especially if you're playing around, want to check it up, spin some stuff up. So DigitalOcean is the easiest cloud platform to run and scale applications. From effortless administration tools to robust compute, storage, and networking devices, DigitalOcean provides an all-in-one cloud platform to help developers and their team save time when running and scaling their applications. So, and pricing is a big deal. So predictable and affordable pricing, you know, leave those complex pricing structures behind. Always know what your business is going to pay per month with industry-leading price performance balance there. So it's a flat pricing structure across all their global data center regions. So we're talking about scalability, flexible configurations for literally any application, industry-leading price to performance, price that's consistent across regions, rapid provisioning, super predictable costs, hourly billing, and you get monitoring and alerting included. So again, the URL, do.co/shoptalk.
So I have a question, kind of dystopian PWA future. Are you ready? I see a lot of frameworks, you know, even Gatsby or something like that, you know, they're like, oh, by the way, PWA out of the box, and, or, you know, NPM install your PWA or whatever. There's kind of this like, or service worker toolbox or something like that. It's just basically like, just install this and we got you covered. Is there a chance, like a threat on the SWAT board here, that we end up with a bunch of crappy progressive web apps that no one knows how to maintain because they just like their framework does it one way and they don't know how to change it? Or what do you see that future as a possibility?
I've seen it numerous times in the past, for sure. I mean, look at sites that were built with Dreamweaver and people had no idea what was going on under the hood and they didn't know how to fix things. You know, I think that, you know, the web app manifest, and in many cases, if you were to crawl the web, which Microsoft actually did with the Bing crawler, and look at all the web app manifests that are out there, there are a lot of them that are just auto-generated by favicon generators and stuff like that, right? Mm-hmm. And not all of them are quality. And not all of them denote that something is actually a web app, right? Or a PWA. So I think that's always the risk. And I think it's something that we on the web have dealt with time and time and time again. So, I mean, I don't know that it necessarily will happen, but I mean, I think if it does, we'll deal with it just like we've dealt with it every time before. Because I mean, it just, yeah, it's a recurring
cycle. It's right? Like the accessibility. Oh, our site's accessible because we used a framework that said it was. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we haven't really directly talked about the idea of progressive enhancement. That seems like that's been a topic that has peppered your career, I'd say. And
indeed, for a long, long time.
which is not, you know, as even if it's a little hard to perfectly pin down what a PWA is, it's probably even harder to perfectly pin down what progressive enhancement is, because it's not either you did it or you didn't do it kind of thing. It's more of a general kind of concept. What do you think of, you know, what's your pitch for it when you think of?
I mean, I think progressive enhancement is very much a philosophy, a guiding philosophy for how you build something. And it's about building for, and people hate to say this, but building for the lowest common denominator. But I tend to think of it as building for the broadest reach. So having the fewest dependencies possible, using the, you know, to kind of go back to the W3C that Jeremy likes to talk about a lot, the code of least power or the source of least power or whatever it is. But you know, if you can solve a problem or declare an interface solely in HTML and get across what it is that you're trying to do and allow somebody to interact with a page solely using HTML, you should absolutely do that. And then progressive enhancement says, you know, hey, if you have a way to improve this experience when certain criteria are met and provide a better experience, then by all means do so. So I think, you know, there are a couple of good illustrations of this. I mean, I think at a baseline, I like to use the button as an illustration, because if you have a button that needs to submit a form, there are, you know, there's umpteen different ways to do that, but generally there's four ways that people do this. They either have an input of type submit or a button of type submit that's part of the form, mm-hmm. or they have an anchor, or they have a div, right? And by default, the input of type submit and the button of type submit look like buttons. They are focusable via the keyboard. You can use the spacebar or the enter key to submit them. Like all of that stuff comes for free, mm-hmm. right? They can submit the form and everything. An anchor by default looks like an anchor. So now you have to have CSS to make it look like a button. You have to sort of abuse the semantics of the anchor because it's not actually going anywhere. It's triggering a JavaScript function to submit the form because it can't submit a form on its own. So you're introducing a JavaScript dependency. If you actually want to expose it as a button to assistive technology, you have to involve the ARIA role of button. You're basically adding all of these dependencies on top of it. And it also isn't submittable by or you can't activate it rather via the space bar, if I remember correctly. So you also have to have JavaScript to do that. A div has none of those benefits at all. So you have to have, you know, CSS, you have to have JavaScript, you have to have ARIA, all of these different pieces to make it act like a button. And if anything goes wrong, if, you know, any part of your requests for those additional assets to make that thing work fails, the person can't submit the form, right? They can't place an order on your website, or, you know, they can't submit a contact form or something like that. So really it's about creating a robust experience that's going to work wherever. And you can always, you know, overtake that with JavaScript, add additional CSS to style it up the way that you want. But none of those are prerequisites for the interface actually functioning. Mm-hmm. And that's a really important distinction. I think also looking to how HTML5 defined the new input types. So if any of you like me tend to mistype things a lot, if you ever typed RDIO for a radio input when you were inputting the type attribute and all of a sudden it was a text box and you're like, why did this happen? That's because text is the default input type. And what's neat about that is that we could use, you know, type equals email, type equals URL, whatever. And the fallback is always a text input, which we've had since, what, HTML2, I think. So forms have been around for a long time. Yes, we don't have, you know, the nice widgety browser goodness that makes it, you know, faster to input a date or a time or a URL or what have you. We don't have the native validation that we might get, but we still have an input that we can use.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's what we've always had. And
what about all this gray area that, like, I think those are like some of the best examples. You know, I even find myself having to remind myself of these things regularly because for example, you're writing a React component and you're just rocking out some JSX. It's easy to make this mistake of like, oh, I used an anchor here. Why would I do that? That it really makes sense as a button element. Let me make sure to get that right and make sure I'm thinking of this HTML just like I would anywhere else. Like, this is HTML. It will land on the page as HTML. Let's use the right elements and the right everything. But it's not, it absolutely requires JavaScript to even be there at all in this case, because it's a React component that doesn't have some element of server-side rendering. So now we're in this weird middle ground of like, have I already 100% failed progressive enhancement because it's not even there if JavaScript isn't run?
I would say probably, because you've created a huge dependency of React being available and having enough RAM to process your React application on the client side, which may not be the case, especially if you're looking outside of the wealthy Western web. You know, there's always stuff that happens, right? And we can't always guarantee that the stuff that we create actually arrives in the state that we sent it. And so I think in order to build more resilient experiences on the web, we need to be thinking of those low level components. But I'll take a step away from that for a moment and kind of go back to your original thing. Like, does it matter if I'm building this thing in JavaScript and JavaScript's already a prerequisite? Why do semantics matter? Right. Well, there's a number of reasons. Let's say you want to consider what it is that you're building potentially being pulled into some sort of browser-based or service-based web reader, right? Like Instapaper or something like that, or reader mode in Edge or Safari. They key off of semantics, right? What if you want your application to be able to work in the, you know, not too far future world of headless UIs? In that case, having things that are of semantic value in there is going to be meaningful for those interfaces, right? To be able to read that. I have a whole article that was just on A List Apart a couple weeks ago on conversational semantics and thinking about the elements that we choose and why they actually matter in terms of being able to kind of get a lead on the world of truly conversational interfaces, whether they're via voice or whether they're via chatbots or what have you. And the more semantic value we imbue our pages with, the more accessible that content becomes, both for people with disabilities who rely on assistive technology like screen readers and such, but also to people who are using, you know, smart speakers and stuff to access content and read the web to them. And to APIs and stuff like that. There's an example I like to give where, you know, if the markup is good on a page, let's say on the homepage of the New York Times, you could technically write something that would enable you to say to your smart speaker, hey, read me the top three stories or the latest three headlines from the newyorktimes.com. And it would go, or just New York Times, and it would go to nytimes.com, and it would look for maybe the three articles with the soonest date using the time element on them, and pull the headlines for you and read those to you, right? If those are all divs, how do we find that information?
So there's plenty to screw up. You know, I mean, I don't know. I guess where the gray area is to me is that, like, let's say, okay, I've failed. It's not server-side rendered. But it doesn't mean give up on everything ever. There's still value to doing a good job. And then maybe we down the road, we can solve the server-side rendering issue. And once we do that, then we're really in good shape.
Absolutely. And I honestly, again, it always comes back to the project and the project's needs. And you know, what your goals are, who your audience is, that sort of thing. You know, in the case of CodePen, for example, interacting with CodePen as a user creating a pen, you know, there is, I think, you know, a certain degree of, you know, a certain degree of compliance with your requirements for JavaScript and stuff like that that's necessary in order to even make that an accomplishable task, right? To build out a pen. So having JavaScript as a prerequisite in that case, I'm totally fine with that. But your pages that are talking about CodePen as a service, that are sort of the more the marketing end of things, those you're going to want to render in every possible scenario, right? You're going to want those available to absolutely anybody. And then you have your, you know, just like applications have had for years, your system requirements for actually using the application, but all of your promotional materials, all of your help documentation and stuff like that should be as broadly available as possible.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the bet that, I mean, we do that for the most part already, but it's fun to talk about slightly more abstractly than the exact thing I work on. But I would think that's what it's going to be a huge conversation in the coming years as things get even more JavaScript-y and even more big, just because people are seeing a lot of advantage of that, even for things like blogs, as we've seen with things like ViewPress and Gatsby or whatever, being huge and influential, is that some people are like, I just like working that way. But it doesn't mean that I have to give up on server-rendered stuff. And these frameworks are saying, you don't have to. Don't worry. We will handle that for you. And yeah. Zeit that does all this, that type of thing. So it's not talked about enough. I feel like as much as people do, that idea of bringing your JavaScript-y way that you work to make sure that it's progressive enhanced possible, it's a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's all about building a resilient experience that will be able to work no matter what. But honest question, based on what you said, is it possible for us to get more JavaScript? Can we add more JavaScript to things?
Oh yeah.
What are we missing? Starting. I guess once Houdini like lands officially, we can fully JavaScript absolutely everything.
Yeah, you're right. What else? What do I possibly interact with that's not JavaScript these days?
When does JavaScript jump the shark? Just for listeners who don't know me, I actually do really love JavaScript, but yeah, I also I think I've been working with it long enough that I've gotten burned with it in a number of instances, and so I recognize that JavaScript is, as an application, you know, you're building an application in the browser, so it's sort of fragile in that way. It doesn't have the same sort of inherent fallback and ability to recover from errors that HTML and CSS do, kind of baked into their core. I mean, if you use a let in your JavaScript, I think it's IE10 and below, Opera Mini, like they won't render any of your JavaScript because you simply had the let keyword in there and they don't know what it is. I mean, that's,
That's tricky. You gotta configure your Babel just right to Because you don't want to, because by not using let, or by parsing it through Babel and picking the lowest common denominator, you're doing a disservice to browsers that do understand it, because it's not just let. Let's probably not that big of a deal, but there's other things that you're missing out on. You're polyfilling a bunch of crap that you didn't need to, probably, that's slower.
You turned a lot of JavaScript into a lot more.
Yes, a lot more worse JavaScript.
And that's why it makes sense to selectively deliver JavaScript, honestly. Like, I have not... You know, we lost conditional comments as of what IE10, but I actually use them to not send JavaScript to, I think it's IE8 and below, because I know they're not going to, you know, I just don't want to bother testing it, right? So I don't deliver JavaScript to them. I don't deliver advanced styles for, like, doing anything apart from a mobile layout and some colors, you know, just because it frees me up to not really have to test in those browsers as rigorously. And I think, you know, using feature detection in JavaScript, using feature detection in CSS, you know, all of those things start to enable us to selectively deliver the most appropriate experiences. One pattern I like actually using, because a lot of people don't think about this, but you actually, within JavaScript itself, not even just within a service worker, you have access to the cache API. So you can actually do feature detection and then do lazy loading via fetch or what have you, and push into the cache API different resources. So loading additional JavaScript files when, you know, a feature is available or something like that is entirely possible. Just within vanilla JavaScript.
All right. Well, we didn't even get a chance to get to the point that your employer has launched Bing AMP today. It's a whole other conversation.
I saw that. Somebody sent me a message about that, and I was like, wait, what?
Well, how about for another episode? Do you want to? We only have a minute or two left here. I know that you do this, and you even alluded to it earlier in this episode, that you do kind of a mentorship thing. Do you want to finish up with a quick explanation or shout out to that?
Sure. Yeah, so last year was the first year I started sort of an official mentorship program. I've been kind of, you know, as people send me emails asking for advice or what have you, I've been doing that for a number of years, but it's all been sort of unofficial. Last year I started an official mentorship program and worked with two folks, and that was super rewarding for me to be able to sort of intensely work with two individuals on sort of meeting their career goals and helping to figure out, you know, where they fit in the web and what they were doing and such. And so this year I've opened it up again. Applications are open until the end of this month, so the end of September 2018, for those on the podcast listening later. But I'm looking to bring on probably another two mentees this year, but I'm looking to work with only people from underrepresented groups on the web. So, you know, for privacy reasons, I'm not asking them to tell me what underrepresented group or marginalized community they're part of, but, you know, I'd like people to be honest, and to basically tell me what it is that they want to do, what they're looking for, why they love the web, and how they think I can help them. And so I've gotten a bunch of applications from all over the world. I'm happy to work with people wherever they are. They don't necessarily have to be based in my time zone or even in my country. But it's a great chance to help them to reach their goals, or hopefully help them reach their goals, and help them progress their career on the web. And I want to make folks successful, especially interested in helping people with writing, speaking, you know, that sort of stuff, since that's something that I've done a lot.
Do you try to tailor it to what they're interested in, or do you kind of have like a program, or are you just like you've managed to like get the number of people who can email you down to two? I guess, what is the
service? No. So the way that I started it last year is we actually, our first meeting or two, I'll pick somebody that I think I have a reasonable chance of being able to help them meet their goals, right? I don't want to waste someone's time. But we sit down and basically map out, like, what are your long-term goals? And then what do we think is accomplishable within the next year, since that's sort of the duration of the mentorship. And then we sort of work on a plan for how we're going to attack that. And I usually do a call with them every other week. That was sort of the way I did it with two people. It made it not a huge time commitment for me on a weekly basis. So we would do like an hour call every other week, and then emails in between as necessary. And, you know, I would review articles that they had written or outlines for talks that they had put together and that sort of stuff. So, but it was completely tailored to the individual and what it was that they needed. And sometimes that changes through the course of a mentorship too.
That's cool. Well, thank you, Aaron, so much for coming on. I think we have like a 4 or 5 more questions we would love to get to. But thank you so much. For those who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Aaron Gustafson, nothing creative there. And if you want to learn more about progressive enhancement and all of that sort of stuff, you can check out my book, Adaptive Web Design. The second edition is available from New Writers. You can actually read the first edition on the web at adaptivewebdesign.info. You can read it for free in its entirety. You can even install it as a PWA. but those are probably the two best things.
Cool. Well, thank you so much. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star, heart, favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter, which has a progressive web app, at Shop Talk Show, for tens of tweets a month, which will be cached locally on your device. And if you hate your job, however, shoptalkshow.com/jobs, get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Wow. ChopTalkShow.com.